You're listening to CivCast on the Kyle Dempster Studios Network. Support us on Patreon at patreon.com/CivCast. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of CivCast. My name is Kyle, and I'm joined here today by our awesome host, Dan. Hello, Dan.
Kyle, hey, Wouter. Oh, wait, I think I just jumped the gun there.
You did, which is fine. Wouter, come out from the shadows.
Hello. From the shadows, once again, I came and conquered all.
Good. We need a little bit more of that. We need a little bit more conquering. And we've got some news today that's going to let everyone conquer a little bit more in terms of a demo. But let's talk about that in a second here. We have some news with a CivCast challenge because it wraps up shortly. And a big thanks to everyone that has been diving into that headfirst. Dan, do you want to quickly recap what the rules are for this challenge and remind them that they've got until next Saturday, the 25th?
Yeah, and it's been great, the amount of participation and so forth that we've been getting in this challenge. So bravo, everybody. You've been doing fantastic. This is the last week of the CivCast challenge. It was a 1v1 duel where you take on the role of the newest Civ in the game, Australia, on a Pangaea map, on a dual size, which is the two-player map size, on Emperor difficulty, where your victory type can be any, and your speed, resources, start position, all of that are standard. The one kind of big caveat, or whatever you want to call it, is that the one AI that you're going up against can, and frankly should, be random, so that we can share and see kind of the different play styles that the AI approaches you with as you play Australia, but also that, you know, so that you can be forced maybe into a different kind of play style. For instance, I saw someone who posted where their opponent in the 1v1 was Scythia. Well, that sucks, and sorry to hear that, because they definitely would be more of a rampaging early game style who wouldn't let you complete something a little earlier, whereas maybe if you're going up against, I don't know, what would be an example of a more passive early game Civ? I find India to be a pretty passive early game Civ. You might be able to get like a quick 60-turn win, which, by the way, I did see posted on Twitter this week. A gentleman posted using the hashtag CivCast challenge that he won the challenge on turn, I believe it was 56. I'm not going to share his info or anything like that today because that's for next week, but turn 56, I mean, that's usually by turn 56, I don't even know if I'm out of the first age. Like, that's craziness.
It really, really is. I mean, that just goes to show people are really ramping it up. And I think, again, I think this going to a monthly version is a much better way to do it. I think we're seeing more participation in those terms. And again, I think it gave people a chance to re-roll and do a whole new game, you know, if they didn't come in exactly where they wanted to. So I think it just encourages a little bit more friendly competition, gives people more time to take part.
Absolutely. And to that respect, what we're going to do, folks, is we are going to give everyone who completes it and uses the hashtag CivCast Challenge a shout out on the show next week. We won't be doing the kind of point-based leaderboard anymore because I didn't find there was much interaction with that, and the three of us kind of agreed that was kind of largely unnecessary. So instead, we will devote a significant amount of time to you and your accomplishments at the, you know, the start, probably the start of the episode next week. So don't think that your accomplishments are going unnoticed just because there's no like point system, because we love you and we thank you for participating.
Absolutely. Speaking of, I was actually going to say, Wouter, do you want to tell us a little bit about what's been happening over on Reddit? Because I know you've been taking some strategy questions and people just been posting thoughts over there. So how's that going for you?
Yeah, it's been great. I love, of course, some extra interaction beyond the show. And since I don't usually get the many questions myself, I like it that people start asking me questions on the subreddit as well, and there I can divulge in as long as I want an answer and actually take a little bit of time to make a coherent like story and explain exactly what I really want. I like it. It's awesome.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. We want to encourage people. Go ahead. Post all your thoughts over there. Post if you have some show topics in mind, things you want us to cover. It's always helpful. And especially if you see any breaking news related to Civ, go ahead and throw us a link on there just to make sure everyone can see it and read it in advance of the show. It's always helpful. And again, you know, Wouter really is taking a lot of time. I was reading your responses. And I mean, you got some people with like a many paragraph answer for them. So that is some rich info. And speaking of info and like learning to play the game, a reminder to anyone that has not seen this bit of news, but the Civilization 6 demo is out now. Thank you for flagging, guys, because you now can do the first 60 turns of the game. This is for PC only, but it also comes at the same time that they're doing a publisher sale on Steam, so you can save 20% off. So if you've got a friend that you're looking to get into this into Civ 6, seems like now's the time. Wouter, you were saying that Civ might actually, a demo for it was what got you into the series period, is that right?
Yeah, I think it's like the time that was still Civ 3, so that's quite a bit ago. I was scouring the internet for a nice game to play, and I came across the demo for Civilization 3, and I think that was up to 100 turns, and I started playing around with it, and I completely sucked at it in the beginning. But I kept replaying that same 100 turns, because usually the beginning of the game is what people find most interesting anyway. And I got hooked on it, and I bought the game in my local store, a physical copy, and ever since I bought it on release, and I was super hyped for it ever since. It's amazing, and I'm glad that they actually bring back demos, because there are not enough demos to go around these days.
I agree with that. Dan, I want to throw kind of that question to you. So now we hear of how Wouter got into the game. Dan, how did you actually get in? Were you a demo sort of guy? Was a friend that encouraged you? What was your story?
Well, the first one that I actually kind of really played on a large scale was Civ 4. And I got to be honest, I don't think there was any kind of, light bulb moment that struck me that made me play the game. I've always kind of loved RTSs, and I was big into the Age of Empires series at the time. I think Age of Mythology was out then. Oh, I was big into, which is a fantastic game. I was into a game called Rise of Nations, which was another kind of more real-time RTS, if that makes sense. That sounds like a bit of a dichotomy, but you know what I mean. And I think I knew of Civ. I heard of Civ. I heard that it was kind of the standard bearer for RTS at the time, and I went and picked up Civ 4 probably on sale because I was a poor student, and fell in love right away. So no demos for me. No, I'm not a huge demo guy. I read a lot of reviews and stuff online, and that generally kind of skews me in a direction whether or not I'm going to buy a game. And I don't find that there's a lot of demos that are available nowadays, really. I mean, maybe a few on Steam, but yeah.
Yeah, they...
Very little, even on Steam.
Dying breed. Very.
Yeah.
But big shout out. I shouldn't be plugging this wrong show for this, but it is a Civcast listener that pointed out, I was just telling these guys here that I was playing that game War Tiles on Steam. It's an early access, but that's a big shout out to our friend Custodian on Twitter. He posted about it, and I had to go pick it up. So thank you, sir. I appreciate the posting in your feed there. That is an interesting game for anyone that wants to go support an indie developer, War Tiles. It's like 15% off right now. So throw your friends the Steam, the Civ 6 demo, and while they're playing that, you go play War Tiles and then have them pick up this thing on 20% off discount. So
it looks cool.
All around wins. I mean, I'm thinking we're getting into this, I don't know, hopefully we're getting into some really cool video games coming out here, just that break the mold of things. And speaking of Age of Mythology, I really want to pick that up for PC too, but it's like $30-some for a game that I owned in 1990-something. Seems like
I own
crazy.
The collector's edition, even. I still have the poster on my wall. It's amazing. Really? It's a good game.
Yeah. That's awesome. They keep releasing expansions for it. I mean, they had an expansion they released for it last year. So I guess they think if they're still pumping out content for it, they could charge halfway its full price for it.
It's just I want to catch it on a Steam sale, because if it were like $15, I could totally justify it. But like $35. A little bit much, but for the new content, I don't care. They can charge full price for that. I just want to try and snag Age of Mythology cheap. So if anyone sees that, throw it my way if it goes on sale. I need to get it and play it with one of my friends. So that'd be fun.
What, you don't expect the new content for free, Kyle?
No, I don't, because I support people with money.
But do you guys think that the demo would actually still bring people to the game with the current age of piracy and everything like that? Do you think that demos are really something that people are looking out for, or is it more like an outdated thing that we had back in the good old days?
Dan, do you want to take that first?
Yeah, I mean, I remember getting demo discs with my old PlayStation magazine, and man, those things actually sold me on games. Like, I remember playing the demo. I had this really weird distinct memory, and holler at me, folks, if you know this game. I'm playing the demo obsessively, this game called Medieval for PlayStation. I played the demo, which is on the PlayStation magazine demo disc, like for hours and hours and hours. And then I went out and bought the game, and the game itself was not really all that good. I think I played the demo probably 10 times longer than I actually played the game.
Wow.
But back in the day, Voucher, you're right. Demos used to really, I think, sell people on games. But nowadays, I think that people have immediate access to everything. So they have no desire to try a half-formed version of something, right? I mean, you get things like EA Access for games like the new Mass Effect game, where you get to play it a week in advance and you get to find all the funny little facial animations and everything before everyone else. So in that sense, that's almost like a demo.
Also, we got Steam, which will let you return a game up to, what, like 2 to 3 hours worth of playtime, right? It's something like that. So maybe that's why they did it for Civ 6, is they thought that, Civ takes a little bit longer sometimes, especially if you're new, that you might not be able to get so much done in the first 2 or 3 hours. And I've seen that on like the Reddits and stuff like that, where people were saying, oh, you know, I picked it up. This is in the early days when more people were saying they didn't like it. It seems like after these patches, it's turned itself around a lot. But at the start, I think there were complainers saying, they couldn't get that far into it before they actually wanted to return it on Steam. So maybe it also helps people with a price point thing, like an entry level. You know, if they're seeing, hey, I can actually try this. I don't know. I don't think it fits our era so much, but I don't think it's a bad thing. Is it?
Maybe I'm still a remnant of the older days, because I remember those discs that you talked about as well. I love them, and I still would play demos of games quite a bit to see if it's actually worth buying it. Because when I buy it on Steam, I have never returned a game on Steam, because I don't buy it to just try it out. And if I don't like it, return it. That doesn't click well in my mind. But yeah, maybe I'm just getting old.
We all are about here, but I'm on board with you.
Let's see, what do we have next here lined up? So I thought we could kind of toss this one around. A good friend of the show, Copper Cutters, on our Reddit posted something, Valter, which maybe I'll let you take lead on reading this if you'd like. Maybe break this down into a couple different points, because you gave him a great answer to his feedback here. You want to go ahead and read that, or part of it?
Yeah, right. So on the Reddit, Copper Cutters wrote in and asked me, like, that he has played quite a lot of Civ so far, England, France, Congo, Australia, and Rome. And usually he tries to do a scientific win. And he finds it a bit more difficult, like, how can I go around and do a domination win? Because usually when you play Civilization, I think that goes for most people, the science win is kind of the default win. If you don't win by any other way, then you're probably going to try to win through science, because it naturally leads you there with the tech tree. Mm-hmm. And the domination, if you want to win that way, you have to actively pursue it, because if you don't, the game is not going to let you in that direction unless everybody declares war on you and you kind of want to revenge kill them or something like that. And what he really wanted some tips are like, how many units do I get? How many range versus melee? Do I raise the cities? Do I keep them? And some general tips for movement. And I broke it down a bit on the Reddits, but I can give like a short summary here. And there, you don't really have to completely neglect your economy, but you should still focus stack-wise upon the military units. And specifically, I would recommend focusing down on one specific unit that could be a melee unit, which means you go for gunpowder quite quickly. Mm-hmm. Or I prefer cavalry a lot myself. So you can go choose light or heavy cavalry and focus upon the upgrades to those really quickly, just so that you beeline to those stacks, so you have a strong power advantage against your enemy. And the most important thing that you have to build, in my opinion, when doing any domination victory is a siege tower, because walls are a bitch and you don't want to bring those slow siege units towards all those enemy cities. And with a siege tower, you can do full damage against an enemy's walls and everything like that. And it goes super fast and you don't need those slow ass siege units around. You can just go around with your cavalry. My best memories of that have been with some tanks that I had. I think I was three tanks, a siege tower, and I just raced through the enemy nation, bringing down every city that he had, because I had really advanced units compared to the time age with a siege tower, so walls didn't matter anymore.
So question, interjection, raising my hand. You had tanks and a siege tower.
That's what I was going to say. I was going to ask that.
Historically interesting. Right?
Siege towers will be useful to the end of the game, because I think it's with civil engineering, every city will have walls, kind of. You can't build walls anymore, but every city has that defense. And you still have to break through that. And the only way to really do that is with a siege tower, because that will still allow you to do full damage with a melee unit to those walls, which aren't really walls anymore, without a siege unit. So even in the late time of the game, siege towers are really powerful.
Okay, logistics question. I understand a siege tower. Men get to the top. They climb over the wall. How does the siege tower, built presumably out of wood, work with tanks? Do you hoist them up there? And did you roll over the wall? I mean, I'm confused here. Something seems broken.
Well, if
that
you have
is
tanks,
what we call an anachronism, folks.
If you have tanks, you probably have some assembly line kind of feature or something like that. So maybe assembly line your tank away over the walls. I don't know. It's the same thing with civil engineering. You don't really have walls anymore, but it's more like civil defense or something like that. I'm not sure how they did it, but it's like they abstracted it a little bit.
That's a good tip.
I just have this image. Sorry, Kyle. No. I just have this image in my head of these two guys at the top of a siege tower with ropes, like trying to hoist a tank up there.
Yeah.
They're like, pull! And they get the thing to the top, and it weighs like quadruple what the tower itself weighs.
Yeah, I'm concerned for them and the structural integrity of this tower, but whatever floats their boat, or I should say whatever floats your tank.
This is good
tips for people that are new, especially, I mean, if people are going to be doing this demo and trying stuff out. These are Copper Cutter's put in some good entry level stuff, because he said he was new to the game and trying to figure this out. So that's a really good one, Wouter. I rarely use siege towers, and I don't know why. I need to plan out my attack better, I think.
I believe that you were more of an aggressive player, so I could really recommend you getting at least a couple of siege towers when they're available, because I think when you can't build walls anymore, you can't build siege towers either. So they get them when they're fresh.
Get them while they're hot, everybody. You heard it here first, Wouter's hot tip on siege towers. So let's see, he also had asked kind of what sieves and tips we might have and what sort of ratio between ranged units and melee and what cities to keep and to raise. I mean, these are all good questions for someone that's coming to this game, because very early on we addressed the idea that this this sieve potentially has one of the larger entry-level learning curves, just based on like you having to manage where you're putting districts and, you know, what points. I think, at least speaking for myself, when I was completely fresh and new to this game, to Civ 6, I should say, I was confused about what points to prioritize, like what sort of bonuses I wanted over others. Wouter, maybe do you want to kind of talk just briefly about like what sort of cities do you want to keep there? I mean, that's kind of a good question. Do you raise a lot? Do you keep them all?
Well, I'm a guy who settles as many cities as I can get my hands on. And they do pretty much the same, I guess, for normally for cities that I conquer. But if you are trying to do like a proper game where you want to play as best as you can, then I would recommend raising most cities of the enemy. You can always settle them later again, right? Mm-hmm. And they don't grow while they're occupied anyway. But if you want to keep them cities, then there are pretty much two or three reasons. One of them is your units need to heal, because they heal faster in friendly borders. And when you conquer a city, you will gain a lot of friendly borders on that front all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. Two, your units need to be upgraded. You can only upgrade in friendly borders as well. So if you don't want to race back your army all the way home, you'd rather do it on the front lines. or three, if it's in a strategically important place, for example, a choke point, then it can be quite advantageous to leave that city, especially if it has a nice encampment and a walls already. Yeah, you might want to keep it.
Those are good tips. Okay, I'm going to toss this kind of to both of you here, because this is one that I admittedly have struggled with all of Civ. I mean, it's something, I think it's just by the very nature of the game, correct me if I'm wrong, but he asked, what do you do when you get bogged down, or he finds that he gets bogged down a lot in movement, and either having too many units or not enough. Dan, do you have a thought on that before we go to Wouter and get his expert opinion?
Well, so I'm assuming that... that he, and again, I must say he, but I'm assuming that he means that he gets bogged down in like actually getting individual units from tile to tile.
Yeah, I'm guessing he means like moving the entire army, which I admit I've struggled with that plenty in the past. Do you find that?
Or yeah, no, I agree. No, absolutely. And I've found that in passive games, but I think they remedied a lot of this or a lot of that problem. I would assume that this applies to later on in the game with the combinations into the regiments and into the, I can't forget what the other one, what's the other one called?
Army.
Is it Army and then?
Are you talking?
Corps, thank you.
Yeah.
So that I think cuts down on a lot of the time, I don't know what it is, a time impediment, a time sink of moving units from tile to tile. Because I agree, certainly in my Civ 5 experience, it was an impediment to a domination victory. When you'd have this huge army that you were so proud of, and yet you'd have to be like, okay, well, this guy I have to move first here. And then behind him, I move this guy up. And behind him, I move this guy up. And so yeah, I would agree in that sense. And that can also, if you don't have a fast computer, by the way, that could be a huge drag on your CPU. But, I mean, for me, I think they've remedied a lot of that with the combinations. And then on the sea into fleets and armadas in Civ 6. And I think that not only do those prove to be significantly more powerful uses of single hexes, but they do serve to cut down on a lot of the burden of moving individual units around from tile to tile.
I'm in full agreement there. And also want to remind people that there's also eventually get that military policy card that lets you move one extra movement point when you're in friendly territory, which doesn't sound like a lot, but I find it to be pretty good. You know, if you're stretching your empire wide and maybe you have a lot of points or a lot of policy slots you can use, that's a good one. Wouter, any hot tips on what to do when your army gets too large?
Well, on that policy card that you just mentioned, I use that a lot as well, but not for my military units. I use it for my civilian units because my workers get an extra movement. That's really awesome. But as to the being bogged down, I generally don't really have that problem. I'm a big chess player myself, so I kind of see it more or less as an advanced form of chess, I guess.
Yeah.
With the way your units move and everything like that. And since I don't really have a diversified multi-purpose army and are really like one type of units mostly, because those are really up to date and can probably kill whatever comes at me just by the sheer force of being a more advanced version of it. I tend to not have that much problems with it. That's pretty much the way I just overpower my enemies with what I have and just make sure that I have enough of that. And that makes the dance a lot easier for me.
So, can I follow up with a question on that, Wouter? You said that you focus on like one specific kind of unit. Because I know a lot of people, whether it's for enjoyment purposes or aesthetic purposes or strategic purposes, really, including myself, frankly, really like to diversify armies, whether it's an early game and you have like warriors mixed in with cavalry and mixed in with archers, or later game and you have a diversified kind of infantry and tank-based army. Are you saying that you find it to be far, far more effective to just have like a full army of that one badass overpowered unit as opposed to kind of mixing things up? Because there is the rock, paper, scissors dynamic to what units are strong against others. Are you kind of saying that you can disregard that at certain points?
Well, the thing is that in the current way of the game is that it really depends on which age your unit is to see how powerful it is. So the rock, paper, scissors thing is true, but it's mainly true for equal age units. So a spearman would kill a horseman, for example, because those are in the same age. But if you would put that same spearman, for example, against a knight, then that Spearman would have no chance. Even though it has the rock, paper, scissors advantage, the sheer extra power that the knight brings from being a higher tier H-list unit just blows away the advantage that the Spearman has. So I do think that focusing upon a single one, and I usually focus on the mobility guys, which are the cavalry units, either light or heavy, and with that, go beeline for a good tech for that and just blow the enemy out of the water with just that.
Interesting. I find that very interesting. Dan, I'm with you. I was traditionally going like a lot of different types, but that's a great, that's an interesting approach to it, Wouter. Good perspective.
And it doesn't mean that you don't have any archers or something like that, even if they're just on par with the enemy. I mean, you can bring them along, but usually they will be because I had some left over or something like that from the beginning of the game.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Let's see. One more. We'll take one more question from this email here, or this Reddit post, I should say. And so this Copper Cutter is already going science. So I think that ties into what you were saying, Wouter. I mean, if he knows science and has done science wins, then push forward to go for one unit, I think is what you said earlier. And then you take that one unit per your last point and just utilize that really strong one. So take your science knowledge, build up to one powerful guy, whether it's the musket man, whatever, and then swarm them with those. That's a good strategy. So
it works well.
This question here is asked, what sieves are good to go for domination? I mean, we all, let's everyone pick one sieve here. If you had to choose one to go with the domination victory, who would you choose, Dan? If you have one off the top of your head.
The Aztecs.
Oh, okay. Why is that?
Early game domination is really the only kind of domination that I generally pursue. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think I've talked in the past about how I love later game domination plays because you get to roll out some really cool looking modern military units. But I find it's also super difficult to conquer, say, an 8 AI game if you wait until, like, you know, post-industrial age. So for me, an early game powerhouse like the Scythians or the Aztecs, whom I just love in general as a civ, would be a favorite of mine. The Eagle Warrior is a complete badass, and I'm just a fan.
The good one. Very good one. Wouter, what's your choice?
Dan hinted on it already, and my choice is Scythia. It's super powerful in the fact that, and also if you are not used to a domination game, they're really good to learn the movement because they regain 50 health if one of their units kills an opponent, which means even if you are taking some losses in some damage on your unit, there's an easy way to heal them again. And like I said before, I am a guy who likes to go with the mobility of cavalry. They receive a free cavalry, a light cavalry unit each time they build one. So you get a lot of cavalry units for the same amount of hammers. That's amazing.
I think I would have.
Yeah, that's a crazy ability. People of the Steppe, their unique ability. That is overpowered for sure.
Yeah, I think I
actually think
that
Killer of Cyrus is better, where they get healing points every time they kill a unit. It's really, really good.
I think that might be the one that he should try, is Scythia. I was going to say, I like Germany a lot, as we all know. I talk about them all the time, but yeah, that extra combat. I'm sorry, military policy slot's a great one. So that helps. I mean, but their production bonus too obviously helps you field more units faster. But I think Scythia would be a really good one for him to try if he hasn't already, because to your point, with both of those abilities, you know, popping out an extra unit and getting some healing upon a kill, that's a really good way to rush a domination victory early game. So Copper Cutters, hopefully you can get back to us and let us know if you've had any success with those, because we'd love to hear back on that. And Wouter, I think, gave you a larger post there on the Reddit, so hopefully that stuff helps. Again, everyone, we really encourage tons of feedback. So if you have any questions for the show, questions for Wouter on strategy, you know where to send them. That's the civcastpodcast@gmail.com, and you can go post stuff on the Reddit too, post ideas for the show. And I thought we could take a couple minutes here, guys, to talk about a conversation we had last week. We had at the very, very end of the show, and we kind of made fun of it a little bit in this episode, but using civilization for education. I know we kind of got into this topic just because we were talking about how it encourages people to dive into the past. And even just yesterday on Twitter, I saw someone thanking Firaxis and the Civ game for helping them pass a test. And I think it's an interesting question because this game got some flack for its historical inaccuracies. And correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, because you are the historical expert here just across the board. But I think, like, even for Germany, Frederick shouldn't be wearing plate mail armor because he lived before the time of plate. So maybe I'll toss this to you first. Do you think civilization has a place in classrooms like some people have used it? Or where do you stand?
Give you a little story. And yeah, Kyle, like you were saying, and just to give people kind of a background so they don't think I'm talking out of my ass, I do teach history at a college level, so I do sort of know what I'm talking about when I talk about these things. And I would never use Civ necessarily as a teaching tool. What I would use it as is for young kids, I would use it as an introductory tool into the past and into the stories of the past. Because ultimately what it is that excites children about studying things like history isn't like the history of the stock market, or isn't the history of ideas and thought, or people like Voltaire or Adam Smith. That's not what gets them excited. What gets them excited is armies and battles and warriors and things like that. So in that sense, Civ is fantastic for that. I do know the one time I actually used a historical video game in a classroom setting was to show, when I was teaching the Congress of Vienna, what I did was I pulled up the end map of one of my Europa Universalis IV games, and I showed people kind of like what the European map could have looked like, because I played a Europa Universalis IV game that ended up pretty close to what the Congress of Vienna ended up delineating, only with, I think, a much more powerful France. And so I showed them what Europe could look like, and then I showed them the event for the Congress of Vienna and that whole process and everything. And we played around with it for like 15 or 20 minutes. And I had a kid come up to the end of class and be like, "What game is that?" I told him what game it was, and I don't know if he went out and bought it or whatever, but I do think, long story short, that historical video games absolutely have a place in the educational process. The classroom, I'm not so sure, because, yeah, there's, you know, you can't teach kids that, oh, look, you can hoist tanks up siege towers. Hmm. No, then they're going to have a pretty skewed view of history. But if you want to teach someone, or to that matter, I remember having a kid who played Civ, talking about Gandhi and how Gandhi was particularly aggressive, and then that kind of skewed his opinion on Gandhi and history, right? Because you have to think that Gandhi is actually a pretty peaceful, non-militaristic guy. But what you can use Civ to do is you can use Civ to introduce people to young kids, particularly to ideas, to leaders, to the beauty of the study of history, and to just kind of a general appreciation of just, I don't know what the term I'm looking for is, just collected knowledge, right? Just knowing these people and knowing these civilizations and these units and these abilities, and especially with Civ 6, how true to history a lot of these abilities are. I've talked about Peter the Great's ability and the way that they've done such a fantastic job of making him historically accurate. I think in that sense, it is a great tool. I wouldn't use it to teach a bunch of university kids, you know, what the Meiji Restoration was, because it's just, it doesn't have the depth necessarily, but it is a fun tool to introduce kids to the field and to the different characters of history.
I think that's a great point, because that was Age of Empires to me. That game really did spike my interest for learning about groups, and that was many years before I'd been in a class where I'd study the Aztecs. And if anyone's familiar with Age of Empires 2, the Aztecs got introduced. They had a big campaign, and I was very familiar with like the naming conventions for them, because maybe you can criticize voice actors if they screwed it up or not. I don't know, in pronouncing like Tenochtitlan and stuff like that. But when I went and was in classes for it, and you know, even the teacher had no idea how to pronounce some of these cities, I was like, oh, you know, I'm familiar with this. I rated that, or you know, I was defending it. Valder, did you have anything like that in your childhood, or anything that really spiked your interest in terms of games that maybe encouraged you for history?
Well, like what Dan said, I'm a big European Universalis player as well, and I learned a lot of geography, at least from it, pretty all places of the world. And another Paradox game, Victoria, I learned a lot of like events of the Industrial Age and how things kind of what happened in those period at least. And that drove me to want to learn more about it. And that's the same thing for Civilization VI, at least. Like, every leader has this special ability, which is kind of rooted in some historicity or something like that, at least. And through that, you can become interested in it and look it up. The same happened when Australia was announced that John Curtin would lead them. I think the Google searches for who is this guy spiked up immensely because people just wanted to know, like, okay, this guy's going to be in this game that I play. I'm interested in it now. Let me search what actually happened in history. What did this guy do? And why does he deserve a place in this game? And I think that goes for most of the abilities that every leader has. There's a story behind that. And if you like that leader and you play a lot with it, you become interested in, like, okay, I know that it gives me this bonus, but I'm kind of curious why it is. The same I had with, I think it was Brazil. They get that special unit, which is a battleship. And I had no idea what was the story behind that. So I looked it up, and it was something completely different than what I expected. But these kinds of things can help you bring people to the true history of what happened. And if you really want to use it, if you really want to use the game as a historical teaching tool, I don't think you're succeeding well, but I would suggest go let them play a scenario, and they are only taking 60 turns anyway, so it's relatively short. And after that, do a more in-depth lesson about it, because everybody has then kind of a base knowledge, like, this is how the thing looked like, this is how the situation was. And these are the actors in it, and you can visualize them really well because you actually encounter them. And through that, you have enough hooks to put, like, the true story of history on it.
I think that, yeah, like Dan said, very, very well said, Wouter. I want to ask one more question to you guys regarding this topic, and then we're going to move on to something Dan had, because this is something that gets debated back and forth. Do you think that Firaxis is kind of beholden to correct, not correct retroactively? I'm not actually suggesting they go back and fix things. But if there are glaring mistakes like the ones that I referenced with Frederick, you know, if he lived and died before plate mail was invented, and yet his character very, very boldly wears it every time you see him, is that something that they need to be more careful about going forward, do you think? I mean, is that something that in the back of one's mind kind of does set younger kids that are learning these topics, does that kind of damage their entry level to it, do you think? Like, is that just teaching them or giving them the wrong precedent from the start? Dan, do you want to take that first, maybe?
Sure. I don't think necessarily it does. I mean, in one sense, you've got that, and you're absolutely right that that is... an anachronism, but you know, you also have some of these delightful Easter eggs. Like I've talked about in the past, how Catherine de' Medici has the three individual crowns on her black dress there because she's in mourning for the three sons of hers who died on the French throne while she was kind of the queen mother. So, in one sense, you're right. There are some things that they should be beholden to. I mean, you shouldn't have Hojo Tucumune in an astronaut suit. But, you know, in the other respect or in the other sense, I think that they've done a good enough job with this. And as long as they stay generally on the right track or the historicity and making sure that these things are the basis of the way that they construct the sieves and not just an afterthought, that they construct the sieves and their strengths and their abilities based on, you know, where they are situated in the historical landscape, I think they're doing fine. I think that, you know, you do mention one that that is accurate, Kyle, and one that might, you know, bug a few people. But I don't think really, as it pertains to Frederick Barbarossa in Germany, there are any other kind of historical inaccuracies. And I don't think it's getting in my way of my enjoyment of the game, I guess. But they should be aware of it for sure for the future.
It doesn't spoil my fun. So, you know, I don't care. Wear all the plate armor you want. I just always see that one reference, and I think that's interesting. Wouter, have you any last thoughts on that topic before we move on?
Yeah, I agree with Dan. It doesn't break it too much for me. I think they are allowed to take some creative liberties to make the characters compelling in their kind of view, and that it is not always 100% historically accurate. I guess that's just the first lesson, that history is never 100% historically accurate.
I like it. Well said. Thank you both for that topic, because I thought that was a little fun to continue from last week. Dan, you have something to talk about, which is what civs piss us off the most. Tell me more.
No, I just found this on Reddit. I thought it was a fantastic question to toss to you guys and have a bit of a discussion about which civs do piss you off the most. So in the Reddit post, they were talking about civs who just always seem angry, or civs who always seem aggressive, or civs who always backstab you. And I don't think there's any civs that necessarily have particular biases in one direction or the other. I mean, there are obviously civs that have tendency to be more aggressive or things like that. But I think it really does ultimately come down to individual experience. So Kyle, I will toss it to you first, whether in your collective civilization play history or just in your play history in Civ 6,
ooh,
is there a civ that stands out to you as being one that pisses you off a lot, that really gets under your craw?
Yeah. I wasn't thinking larger scale. I might have to take an extra minute when Wouter gives his to think about long term if I have anyone. I think in Civ 6, though, I'm going to give it to Egypt, because Cleopatra's always nagging me that my army's not big enough, and to the point that it's sometimes funny, because I've conquered like half of her empire before, clearly showing that I've got a larger army than hers. I mean, that's her bias, right? She likes when your army is bigger than hers, etc., and she respects power. But the thing is, you know, I conquer half your empire and you're still complaining that my army's not strong enough. What do you want? Like, if I take your capital for this, you know, if I take your second capital, is that good enough for you? Is that good enough? What? So that's mine.
I think when Gilgamesh pops up, I get a little bit insecure seeing all those muscles. But beyond that, like for the guy who really pisses me off the most, that has to be Harald, because always he's telling me that my seas are unprotected and I should build more ships. But I usually play on Pangaea, so ships are not that important. So I feel like, yeah, I know, but come at me, bro, because I'm going to blow your ships out of the water with my land units anyway.
Yeah, you're all like, what ships, right? For me, the one that always kind of gets under my craw is Gorgo of Greece, because her civilization leader, and she always seems to go to war with me, and that's because she dislikes civs that have not gone to war. And so if you meet her early on and you're trying to play more of a passive game, like a culture game or a science game, then she just automatically gets pissed off at you. And I don't think I've had a game with her where she has not declared an early war on me. Every single game I've had with her, she'll declare war on me basically by like turn, I don't know, 50 or 60. That is a pain in the ass when sometimes I'm going for a super kind of passive, maybe science victory.
That's a good point. I'm now questioning if I've had a game with her where she hasn't declared war. I was on one last night, guys, maybe it was Friday, yesterday? I don't remember. I was live streaming a little bit of Civ. It must have been last night. And I was playing as England, and I did the island plates map, and I was literally stuck on one tiny island that I could not get off of because, you know, I didn't know shipbuilding yet. And yet we had met Rome, and he's over there throwing insults at me about not expanding my borders. And I'm like, what do you mean? I can't. I literally cannot get off of this island to send my settlers anywhere. Just chill, bro. Chill. So that's a good
one. Trajan in Rome, he's super aggro too, because his leader agenda is I guess you could say it's kind of situational. If you're in that kind of situation, you're kind of screwed, and he's going to be angry at you regardless. But I think everyone knows that most civs are angry at you early game, no matter what you do.
Even John Curtin got mad at me. His first impression was negative. Like, what's up with that? Can I throw that to you guys? Do you have that issue as well, where sometimes do you find that the leaders are just naturally not happy with you, period? I'm getting a lot of games where if I don't immediately throw money at them for if I don't immediately do the first like 25 gold, then the next turn.
Delegations.
Yeah, thank you. Delegation. If I don't do the delegation the first second I get the opportunity, they won't accept it from me ever. Anyone had that?
Yes, and they reject my delegations, the assholes.
Yeah. What is with that? Kalter?
The thing is, like, diplomacy, like in true life with friends, it's a thing that needs to be cultivated. You need to put a lot of effort in it to reap the rewards, kind of. Aww. And that is like take some time to make a good trade deal with them, make sure you get open borders, because they're quite willing to do open borders usually. If you can't get open borders to them, make sure they have open borders to you at least, because that's a diplomatic boost. And you know beforehand what their standard kind of policy is and try to play towards that to make them friendly. And I've had many games on deity level where I have fulfilling alliances with other civilizations. Not everybody, because you can't be friends with everybody. That's just not going to happen. You should put that out of your head from the beginning. But you just need to cultivate those relationships, try to put some effort in it, and for sure, you will make friends then.
Not with everybody. Sound like a Civ therapist. I love it.
Truly.
Maybe I am.
Can we do that maybe next week? I would love to hear more about like trying to befriend civilizations. Because again, this game I just referenced, I'm friends with a lot of people and I didn't do anything to become their friends. I have like 3-4 friends out of a 6-8 player map, something like that. But traditionally, I have no friends. No one likes me and I am alone. So
can we isolate that little audio clip there and just play that and repeat?
Yes, I have the ability to really isolate that. Yes, I'm the one that can do that. Yeah, I'm alone, so help. Anyway, so next week, let's talk about that. Dan, do you want to talk a little bit about your Civ of the Week you've got in mind?
Absolutely. So I thought that we could talk about the Civ that we talked about last week as being the most played Civ in Civ 6, because we haven't really touched on them. And that's Rome. So what are your experiences with Rome as a Civ in this game, guys? And I guess I'll throw it to Wouter first on that.
I like it. It's really it's really newbie friendly because you get that starting monument in your cities. So if you expand, you immediately get more culture, which is quite nice because culture tends to be the one that people fall behind on the earliest. And the fact that roads get built immediately is really nice for people who are not familiar with how roads get built in Civ 6. So yeah, it's a really great Civ to learn the ropes with, I would say.
I would absolutely.
I'll back that up too. I was just going to back up his point. I mean, I think it's a really good entry level one for people, and I think we saw a lot of that when Civ 6 first debuted. Is most people were saying they wanted to jump into Rome first for that reason because it's a build it wide sort of Civ, and their units, their legion units, are pretty awesome.
Yeah, no, they are, as you say, a great entry-level Civ, and they're one that I think people are super familiar with, historically speaking. They're one that's been in every single Civ game, right? So, I mean, I don't find them particularly exciting or overwhelmingly powerful, but anytime I'm against them in AI, they're always a factor, and anytime I play as them, I never feel as though there's a situation that I can't adapt to. All roads lead to Rome. Their unique ability is... Again, I would say a useful ability in virtually every game, but maybe not one that we would look at as being significantly overpowered, like a culture bomb from Poland or like a double unit from Scythia. I don't know if you guys would agree with that.
I think so.
Yeah. I think the thing is with roads being a little underpowered, not underpowered, but you know, roads are not the same time commitment as prior. Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think it's as OP as it could have been if that were like a thing in Civ 5.
I do think it's worth considering whether or not, and I'll bring the history back in here, whether or not one day we might see an actual modern Italian Civ under someone like Giuseppe Garibaldi. Because I feel like the Italians are a civilization who's kind of underserviced in this game because the default, you know, is always to go with Rome. But they do have, a significant modern history and an exciting one, really, that I've read a lot about and would be fascinating to get a modern Italian Civ. Around their time of unity in the mid 1800s.
I would totally support that. I would love to see that. Garibaldi is a guy I read a lot about as well, so I would definitely love to see him leading it. But it's probably not going to happen. It's going to be a Victor Emmanuel or something like that.
Yeah, true.
Well, I am. I'm curious to see what happens there as well, especially with these new modded leaders coming about. I think I saw Hadrian. Maybe speaking of Rome, is that something? Any of you guys see that Hadrian on the Steam store or workshop?
No, I've seen Hadrian in the past in past iterations. I think it's Civ 5. There was a Hadrian mod, and that would definitely be an interesting one. As a Scotsman, I'm not a huge Hadrian fan, but yeah, I mean, Rome, you have a lot of options. And actually, that's kind of what I was going to segue into with my historical minute. I don't know if you want me to just launch into
Please.
That right now.
Okay,
cool. So like I said, Rome has been a Civ since the beginning of the series. And it will surprise virtually no one that the leader for Rome in the first four iterations of civilization was Julius Caesar. Of course, the most probably famous, the most well-documented and well-recorded of Roman leaders. In Civ 2, you did have the option of an alternate female leader, Livra, interestingly enough. And in Civ 4, you see the transition to Augustus Caesar. Now, Augustus Caesar is not, I guess if you look at the pantheon of Roman leaders, Augustus Caesar is probably number two or three in terms of importance and in terms of relevance. But you see him as being the secondary leader for Rome in Civ 4, and then you see him as the primary leader in Civ 5 for Rome. Civ 6 gives us a completely new leader in Trajan. And people might not be as familiar with Trajan, but he is the leader who presided over the Roman Empire at its territorial zenith. So when Trajan was in charge, Rome's territory stretched from the Euphrates to the tip of Scotland, to Hadrian's Wall. It was an enormous empire. And Trajan himself wasn't particularly militaristic. He's kind of best known as being a guy who surveyed the empire on horseback and toured and tried to make diplomatic relations with people, but wasn't necessarily a Roman leader who was out, you know, leading the armies into battle. And interestingly enough, he's one of the few Roman leaders to die in a hospital bed. He didn't die on horseback or in some kind of glorious battle pose or via assassination. He just died in bed of sickness. But Trajan is, I don't really necessarily know why he's a little bit less researched, a little bit less regarded, perhaps because his history isn't as dramatic as someone like Julius Caesar, maybe because Shakespeare didn't write about him. But he is a fascinating guy. And to close out my historical minute, folks, if you are a person who loves the history of ancient Rome, and I will admit that I'm not a huge Roman scholar. I took one class on it in university. It was interesting enough, but I'm more of a modern historical guy. But I have sitting on my shelf one of the best historical books that I have ever read, and it is a recent publication that I'm going to give a plug for. And it's called SPQR, and it's by one of the best classical historians going today. Her name is Mary Beard. It's a history of ancient Rome, and it is awesome. I'm about 40 pages in, and it details it kind of breaks it down by, you know, how the geographical history really bred the Roman people. And then it launches into a history of the emperors and does a great job of walking that tightrope between military and great person history. And then also, like, you know, the economic and geographical and religious kind of undertones that also fed into the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. So a lot of people like looking back at Edward Gibbon's famous 19th century Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire as the go-to text for the study of Rome. And it is. It's a great text. But Mary Beard's SPQR, in my opinion, is the one that I'm going to be teaching my kids now, because it's a fantastically detailed and extremely interesting narrative on the history of Rome. It's on your local bookstore shelves. It's on your Kobos or your Kindles or whatever. So if you're looking for a history of Rome and a great book that's both entry level and also expert level, get it. You won't regret it.
Love it. Thank you for the historical minute, Dan. I also want to confirm, I did a quick Google search. Hadrian is on the Steam store or the Steam workshop right now. So maybe something we can talk about next week too is recapping some of the new leaders that are up there and talking about what makes them stand out. That could be kind of cool as we start to see that, proliferate on the store there. Valter, do you want to tell us a little strategy tip before we round out the show?
Yes, I love to give some strategy tips to people. And I decided to kind of chain these tips together through the weeks. So we will discuss one topic more or less in detail over the following weeks. And I think most people like the beginning of the game the most. I certainly do like the beginning of the game the most. And I like to make most of those beginning turns as well. Because if you do well in those beginning turns, you will snowball into doing super well in the late game. And that starts pretty much with you settle your city, what do you build, right? The biggest question I think maybe in the game is, where do you focus upon putting your first hammers? Because those are going to become really important. And in Civ 6, I usually, like almost always, start with a builder unit. And I think that's different than from every other Civ game that I played, because usually you start with a scout or military unit or something similar to that, or a monument. But in this game, I always start with a worker, unless some really crazy edge case situation that I don't want to play anyway. So after the worker, I don't even go to a building or anything else either. I go for a settler because I like expanding in this game so much. There are some downsides to this strategy, and that is, how do you protect your empire with all these civilian units? And I think we will talk about that more next week, and I will divulge in how to protect your whole empire from being conquered by barbarians first, and later on enemy civilizations.
Ooh.
Might want to give trade.
What was that, Dan?
Might want to give the Romans that tip.
Yes.
Yes, very much.
I love it. That's great. I mean, people are always having questions about what is your build order early on. So start with a builder. That's a good one. Okay. So we're getting to about time here. So we'll start to round this episode off. Remind people, you can check out our Patreon over at patreon.com/civcast. Today was our first time we recorded our little cold open, and you can hear us ramble about all things politics and otherwise, things that, you know, don't standardly make it into the show. So that's fun. I think we're going to have a good time recording those. Everything you need to download the show, to listen to the show, to find the Civcast challenge rules, that's all over kyledempsterstudios.com/civcast. Dan, you are recording a new show of RP Gold today, is that right?
Yeah, we'll be recording it tonight, and the game that we are covering, folks, I know I kind of teased last week that it might be a SNES era RPG. We changed our mind. We are covering the PlayStation classic Metal Gear Solid.
Oh, yeah. So you guys can check that out soon on the feed. It's up on the site. You can find links to it. Valter and I are going to start posting our little Hearts of Iron series that we did. So for anyone that's new to Hearts of Iron 4 or new to those Paradox games, we're doing a playthrough from the start where Valter is very kindly teaching me how to actually work everything. So again, you're going to be able to find links to that on kyledempsterstudios.com. Follow us over on Twitter. I'm at kyledempster7. Dan is at DanTheMax. And Valter is at Innocentius69. The show, of course, is at civ_cast. Feel free to tweet us all the stuff, and make sure you send in those Civcast challenge results. Make sure you use the hashtag Civcast challenge. Easy enough. And send that feedback over to civcastpodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to go give our Reddit some love. The subreddit is rcivcast. Vouchers over there taking questions, and we are looking for you guys to submit some new topics you'd like to see covered in upcoming shows. Again, next week, we're probably going to dive... I'm blanking on it right now. Next week, we're going to dive into making friends with civ leaders and maybe talk about some of those civ leader mods that are out there. So if you have thoughts on either of those, go over to our subreddit and post some things that are standing out to you. If you have a new modded leader that you've seen in the Steam Workshop, send us a link to it, and we will make sure to chat about it. So until next week, everyone, just one more turn. You're listening to Civcast on the Kyle Dempster Studios Network. For more shows like this, visit kyledempsterstudios.com.